This is Garland County Vote 2022, a podcast where we sit down with candidates for local office in Hot Springs. In recent weeks, we've reached out to all city director candidates to participate in one-on-one interviews. Four of the 11 candidates chose to participate. On this episode, we're sitting down with District 4 candidate Dudley Webb. District 4 Director Carol Weatherford chose not to be interviewed. Well, let's talk about what you want to talk about. I know public safety is a big part of your platform. We could talk about that, or we could talk about one of these issues that you think is the most important. I pick these because, you know, those are the goals. The board set for 2023, which seems odd that they set goals when, you know, a lot of them may not be on the board when it's time to implement these goals.
Right. And, you know, affordable housing, that one I've been studying here lately to kind of wrap my head around what that looks like and what direction the city's going. And it's my understanding that the direction that the city would go would come from the strategy that's being provided by this experienced vendor. Mm-hmm. And that was what was just passed, I think, early October. The board did do a 6-1. I noticed where my opponent did have some questions as to why survey was mentioned so many times in that report.
Oh, right, he voted against it.
He did vote against it. This might actually be one of the consulting services that I would favor. And I think Karen was speaking to this at the meeting, is that this is actually the missing component that we have to meet our federal requirements for HUD. And they're going to tell us what those missing pieces are. The how-tos, I think, is what she said. And at $63,000 with a 50-50 split, that's easily justified, I would think. And the vendor in this case is experienced and has done a lot of work for the city in the past, is my understanding too. So the strategy that's coming before the city as a result of these surveys and strategical responses are what will move the city forward in addressing affordable housing. So I would have favored this one.
Okay.
And I think in my opponent's case, it may have been a political move. I think, you know, he's well aware that I think we do too much consulting, and so he might want to jump out there against this consulting service because I'm for the city not doing as much consulting.
Right.
That makes any sense.
When he was making those comments, I was thinking
it looked
staged. I think
they
call that triangulation in politics, where you kind of co-opt the ideas of your opponent.
Right. And I think maybe there may have been some premeditated efforts on that, like where even others might have known that that was coming, but it's like it isn't going to matter. It's still going to pass 6-1. You go ahead and do that and take your stand with that. Because it's my understanding there might even be some business opportunities that come from affordable housing that those in the contracting and constructing business that are local would have an opportunity to work on. So there's some business opportunities too. But I've been focusing a little bit more on affordable housing. The STRs, yeah, that's an issue in 4. There's pros and cons to it. And the pros and cons that I've gathered are essentially coming from those that are in District 4, the residents, the taxpayers, the constituents of mine.
Yeah, I think District 4 has.
It's a lot.
4 and 5, I think, have the most.
Yeah, and a majority of those in 4, they're lakeside. You know, you're going to run into some of STRs back off of Peters Point, Ledgerwood, Pretty Point, Coca Bay. They're off Birchwood. Mm-hmm. There's some STRs. And that's where I found that there are some cons that are coming from those that live in that area because they, for many years, purchased that home and have established their residency there for a decade or more, and they feel these STRs and Airbnbs disrupt the traditional neighborhood feel. They also think there are some renters that are blind to the boating policies that are in law for those that do any type of boating on Lake Hamilton and have witnessed several accounts of renters being out on a boat at 9 or 10 o'clock at night without lights, kind of driving fast.
Yeah.
And even in the day, there's some areas that have no wake that they plow through, and there's kids on paddle boards. They were concerned that there might be some safety issues with that,
too. Yeah, I've never thought of it from that angle.
And there's some video footage that I've actually witnessed firsthand of that happening. Several different documentations of that. And, of course, the noise ordinances and city laws that are in place. Parking is what I've been hearing, too. There's some issues where one home, you know, that has two or three, maybe even four bedrooms can have 20, 25 guests there. And so you've got half at least of the number of people that are there in vehicles that are just kind of parked all over the place, and it prevents locals from being able to travel the right way, and in some cases blocks residents into their home
or emergency vehicles.
Yes. And then the point that I haven't heard specifically from residents, but the perspective that I have that could be viewed as a con, is what kind of message does this send for families who are trying to move to Hot Springs and they have trouble locating homes on the market? And that's due to these homes being snatched up by people or groups of people who live outside of the city that are buying the homes just to turn into an Airbnb. So that takes away a family coming here, you know, with children who could be in our school systems, and the mom and dad who could find employment here in Hot Springs, and so forth. That's the con side. The pros, and this is coming again from residents, but I've heard from residents that don't necessarily have established POAs or, you know, neighborhoods per se, but that have a home that has been in despair for quite a few years, and somebody with ownership of that home passes away. They leave it to their son or daughter. That son or daughter then puts $150,000 or more into renovating that home and flipping it. And now the home looks immaculate and it increases comps in the area. That's, I've heard. And that's from a couple of residents that live on Richard Street.
In your district?
Yes, in my district. I've heard, too, it prevents vacancy, like for homes that have nobody living there. And there's many of those all around the city. It does put somebody in that home. So there's attention being drawn to it. And I've heard, too, that local construction businesses and, you know, just plumbers, electricians can count on pretty steady employment. If we have a home that for many years was left vacant, now has the opportunity for people to maybe not establish residency there, but at least be there for a majority of the days throughout a given year. I think the 400 cap is a good thing that the city did, at least for the time being. Whether that number's too low or too high, I think time will tell. But I do think there needs to be some type of haltage on it, or it could get out of control. And that does address the opportunity for families to move here as well. But I, as far as, like, there were many questions on STRs that went into taxing, that went into laws, great questions, and those questions I would like to see left up to the POAs. I really think they should have a standing, and I think the city should be supportive of their standing. If they're in favor of STRs, and the majority of those that are in that neighborhood and that function on that POA body are in favor of STRs, there you go. And how they choose to regulate and maintain policy, as long as their regulations and policies are in line with city laws and ordinances and it doesn't impede traffic, I'm not seeing how that's an issue.
And what about, you know, I'm getting a lot of calls from people who are reviewing the bills of assurances and covenant deeds in their subdivisions, and a lot of them are hiring lawyers to rewrite their bills of assurance to make it explicit that short-term rentals are prohibited. But, you know, the city has said, well, we can't enforce that. That's a private contract that you have to enforce. But do you think the board or the city, because it's really kind of at the administrative level where all this happens, it doesn't really reach the board, do you think that the city should weigh that when they're issuing one of these special use permits? If one of these subdivisions has that explicitly stated in their bill of assurance, should that factor into the decision, you think?
Yes, I do think it should factor into the decision. If the POA's establishment and their bills of ordinance have set specific guidelines to prohibit STRs, the board should support that. On the flip side of that, and I know of many POAs who have done just exactly what you're describing, and they've gone back in to exclude STRs. And if that's the case, the board should support that. If, on the other hand, there are POAs who either A, lack any type of verbiage to describe STRs, or B, have verbiage that allows STRs, the board should support that too.
Mm-hmm.
And that should be considered when determining who could be a potential applicant for licensure for an STR.
So, you know, the board changed the appeal process on that somewhat, where they kind of put themselves into that process. But there's a question whether the board can really do anything more than the BZA does in terms of just looking at it from, I guess, the standpoint of, well, was the policy followed correctly? They can't really consider, how does this fit in the neighborhood? Does this disrupt the character of the neighborhood? Do you think I think we're going to see one of these appeals come to the board here before the end of the year. Do you think the board should look in? Should that be part of their decision-making? Does this STR disrupt the character of the neighborhood? Does it fit in the neighborhood? Or should it just be, well, the policy was followed, and we think it was followed, there wasn't any errors?
Again, that comes in to, or comes down to, I should say, what direction their POA is taking, or what position their POA is taking on STRs.
Right.
And I think, again, if their POA and their bill assurance has verbiage to allow STRs, then the board should support that. If their verbiage lacks any of that, or has any specific verbiage to prevent STRs, the board should support that too.
Because, you know, I've seen when conditional use permits come up on appeal to the board, and I've seen them kind of look at those appeals through the lens of, does this fit in the neighborhood? Is it going to disrupt the neighborhood? But, you know, with this special use process, it's a new permitting process that really hasn't been tested yet. So it's interesting to see if they will consider that.
That is going to be considering, because I think the question I have initially is, how do you measure how an STR is disrupting a neighborhood?
Right, it's very
besides
subjective.
Word of mouth. Right, yeah. It is going to be a subjective issue where you might have a few of the neighbors in that neighborhood who feel like it has taken away the neighborhood effect, where the others might look at it from a financial viewpoint and think, you know, that house looks a lot better today. I know of $100,000+ that went into renovating it. It's causing my comps to go up. So if I were to ever sell my property, I can get more for my property now because of what's happening there. So because of all of those micromanaging type issues, and the board really not functioning as a realtor per se, I think a lot of those regulatory policies should fall with the POA. And if it's a neighborhood that lacks a POA and they feel like they want to have some say on what's happening around their property with their neighbors, then they should take steps to establish their neighborhood POA and go from there. And, I would support the POA of each neighborhood.
That kind of seems like that's a consistent theme in your campaign. I remember maybe back in September or August, we were at the town hall meeting about public safety, and it seemed like your whole idea is that the residents in the neighborhoods, they need to get invested in their public safety. And it kind of seems like what you're saying with the STR issue. If your neighborhood doesn't like it, then you need to create the infrastructure to challenge it. Kind of take things into your own hands to some extent.
Well, yeah, I think this does allow more control to the people, mm-hmm. versus the government, and kind of decreases the government's functionality on a person's personal property, you know, and what they've invested in, which essentially trickles down to their family values too. And I want to be a resource for neighborhoods in my District 4. So if any type of issue with STR were to arise, and yes, I do stand where the POA should have a great standing on regulations and policy, there may be neighborhoods that lack a POA and they want one. They've got 15 or 20 residents in that area who feel as if they want to provide some regulations on STRs, but they don't have a POA. I'm who they can call. You know, give me a call and say, we want a POA. Can you help us? Can you tell us what the steps are to do that? And, you know, that's the direction I would take. So I'm 100% a resource for every resident in District 4. But I do want the residents to feel that they've got a say on what happens on their property, what happens in their neighborhood. And I want to be a part of that say. I want to provide, you know, those safety measures to be in place as well. But as far as the micromanaging of what happens in their neighborhood, that I think the neighbors know better than anybody else. Who's going to know what's going on and what should happen in someone's neighborhood better than the neighbor, better than the resident that lives there? And when they feel like they have a direction they want to take, but they just need some questions answered and some pieces to the puzzle filled in, I'm there.
So that's a pretty lengthy ordinance that the city adopted last year, and they amended several times.
Is this what we're putting on?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Deal. Okay. That's a big 12-page ordinance, lots of regulations in there. You know, a lot of people complain that the city has a lot of regulations that they don't enforce now or don't have the wherewithal to enforce. Do you think the city's capable of enforcing all of the points in that 12-page ordinance?
I'm not 100% that that's realistic to suggest. And I've got to be honest in telling you that I haven't looked through all 12 pages myself. So, I mean, to answer your question on that, I would probably want to see what's in those 12 pages and then make a decision.
Right. Well, is there any of these other issues you want to talk about?
Yes, there are some other issues. I know the Majestic came out, too. All right. The Majestic property. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's my understanding the city did have some issues selling that property and figuring out what was going to happen there. I'm aware that the city did borrow, I think, just a little less than $880,000 to purchase the property almost 2 years ago, and that money was borrowed from enterprise funds, I believe, solid waste.
So, yeah, $2 million, I think, has been spent out of the solid waste fund on the Majestic, you know, buying the property, tearing those buildings down.
And so I'm aware there's talk of maybe passing this development off to Metro Partnership, to have Metro Partnership take over to help sell and develop the Majestic. I think it's a move that's happening too quick, and I would pass on it right now. I don't know what all the contingencies are with that deal. I do know there's been some meetings held where those contingencies were actually discussed. I don't know what they are right now. So, I mean, having said that, again, I would pass on it. And I want the opportunity to sell the property because I feel if I were to get elected and we've got a potential new board after November 8th, then January 1, that's going to be one of the projects that we start working on pretty hard and heavy. And there's already some movement that's taking place there. And I feel very confident that within 6 months, we'll have somebody purchase that property and we'll have development to start to take place. And so I would just, you know, lean, of course, towards us initializing a profit by selling the Majestic that will cover the expenses that were borrowed from solid waste, because any profit up into what was borrowed, I want to see the city return those funds back to solid waste. And moving forward, I would probably want to review if borrowing any funds from the enterprise funds is ever or should ever be a necessity for the city, too. I'm not so sure that was a good idea.
Do you think if the city didn't act, that remember that rubble and those buildings could still be there? Because I think that's kind of the city's position, is we didn't want this property, but we felt obligated to do something because it's such an eyesore. It sat there for so long and nothing was going to happen. Those buildings would probably still be there if we hadn't interceded. Do you think, I mean, people talk about how this is a great opportunity at the Majestic to do something there that can catalyze development and be a real engine of change there. Do you think that site has the potential to do that, to be something transformative for downtown?
Yes, I do think the site does definitely have that potential. And you know, I would applaud the city's efforts for having it cleaned up and the safety measures that took place. You know, those buildings that you were describing to me, David, it's a good thing that they no longer stand, because they were a hazard to people. And we've got a lot of foot traffic and a lot of vehicle traffic that's in that area, and you know, small children that play there. We've got a school less than a few hundred yards away. In, you know, the downtown areas where tourists like to go. And there are many people who just want to see where the Majestic was. And so for those people that are in that area viewing that site, it's nice to know that at least it's safe to view. However, there's nothing there. And what could go there, I think, essentially falls upon the person who buys it. Mm-hmm. And if we put it up on the market and take the highest bidder and we bring in somewhere around that $2 million mark, then I think we're doing good, and we leave it up to that investor and potential developer to determine what they do with that property. And as long as what they're constructing there falls within the normal zoning restrictions, then it's their decision.
So that's kind of a different view than this.
No special conditions, I don't think, should be in place.
Right.
It's just normal zoning restrictions, and as long as their development falls within those guidelines, then let's just see what happens.
That's kind of a different view than this current board and maybe some previous boards, where they want to have a lot of involvement on what goes there. And you talk to some of the developers, they say that's one of the big impediments to getting something done there, is that, well, first off, you know, the board doesn't want to give that property up, doesn't want to give the title to it before it has some guarantees or things that it wants there. And the developers say, well, that's not how the business works. You have to give us the property before we can get financing and capital for it. So you're kind of saying that as long as it's, you know, fits within the zoning code, that should be the board's only real concern there. It shouldn't be, I guess, micromanaging the process.
Yes, I feel that way. I think we're at a point now, almost 2 years waiting to see what's going to happen. The time to provide that micromanaging has come and passed, and now we got to move forward. There's nothing there, and if we continue to approach this issue with that micromanaging perspective and want to put a finger on every decision that's made there, that takes away from the investor, that takes away from the developer. I think once we sell it, yes, if we sell it, I want to see us gain at least what we borrowed. So I want us to at least pull in that $2 million and provide that money back into solid waste. And once we do that, and we've got assurance that all of the normal zoning restrictions are being upheld by this developer, then is that person or group of people's property, and it's their decision as to what they do with that property. There could be some suggested approaches that take place. We might pass on what we would like to see happen there, and that might even go into the decision making for selling it to a small degree, but not near as much up to the high degree that it's been playing in the past 2 years.
Right.
And you know, there are many businesses I know who have tried to establish commerce here, and Target, Whataburger, Chipotle, to just name a few, Home Depot. I'm not sure where their fit is in the city, but it could very well be there. And I do know at one time we had a deal that almost was at 100% maturity, and that was the 4 to 5 star resort. And in our town of Hot Springs, I'm not sure we have any 4 or 5 star resorts. So that might be something to entertain moving forward, too, is those interested developers who were once at the table to purchase the Majestic property who have now gone away, why not try to reach back out to those who have gone away to see, you know what, the table's back open. Let's talk again.
Yeah, it's such a, I think, a difficult position for the city and elected officials is people really want to see something done there. Like, they want it there yesterday, but obviously it's a hard piece of property to sell or
I do get it. I think a lot of sentimental value was placed in that Majestic, especially for those who have been in Hot Springs for their lifetime or for decades and who remember what it was like when it was at full potential and it was a beautiful sight to see. And they look now and they see this bare ground, you know, and they want to make sure that what is put in that place has as much of a resemblance as the Majestic once did. But the time to do that was there. 2 years went by and nothing's happened. So I think now we've got to look at filling that void and stepping back and not being so micromanageable on how we fill that void, but let's get something there. And the other part of that is that once an investor buys a piece of property and they fall within the normal zoning restrictions and all ordinances are being adhered to, the city's got to step back then and, you know, progress monitor to ensure that those restrictions and ordinances are being followed. But as far as the development, it's got a new owner now. It's their decision. So let's see what happens, and that's where I am. Let's sell it. Let's get something there. Let's move forward.
Okay. Anything else you want to talk about?
You did bring up one of essentially my big...
Public safety? We'd like to talk about that for a while.
My big platform issues, and that is public safety. And I want to thank you for being at the public safety meeting for District 4 in August. That meeting was initiated. I don't think District 4 per se has ever had any quarter safety meeting along these lines. I know in the past 4 years we haven't, but we do have public safety issues that are happening in District 4. And so that was the sense of urgency for me. It's like these issues are happening to residents and taxpayers in District 4 right now. Why not start phase one right now on addressing those issues? And so the idea to have the meeting in August was all based on those pretexts. And, you know, I got to spend probably five occasions with Chief Chapman on 30 to 45 minute sessions apiece to essentially analyze crime rate data in Hot Springs, look at those numbers, and assess what essentially is the most troublesome crimes that are happening in District 4 that could be met with deterrence and then steps to lower the rates. And petty theft, residential burglary, larceny, and even breaking and entering for that matter were four of the ones that I think neighborhood watch programs can address. And by neighborhood watch programs, I'm talking about modern and fully implemented with current curriculum that is being provided from the Hot Springs Police Department into residents to initiate, establish, and then maintain with full fidelity. And after we, you know, examined all of this data that day in August, that evening in August, we determined that is, at least for us, that's phase one, is we've got to get point of contacts in District 4. And point of contacts serve as essentially a representative for a neighborhood. And their neighborhood doesn't just consist of roads. It could be, you know, just surrounding areas. But that point of contact then goes out to their neighborhood to get 15, 20 residents who will commit to following this curriculum being provided to us from the police department. And this curriculum all helps neighborhoods take on practices within their home that protect their family and their property. It, the curriculum all consists of safety measures to take, most of which we probably already know about and take for granted, such as just checking to see that all of your doors are locked at night, and when, if and when you leave your home, your vehicles, if they're outside, ensuring that they're locked. And probably one of the most important is to start a log of all serial numbers. Any item that's in somebody's home that you think somebody could take and get quick and easy money for, like from a pawn shop or from Billy Bob down the street, it's important to list that serial number. Coffee makers, drills, saws, you know, guns, chairs, you know, antique type chairs, anything that's got a serial number, phones, write those serial numbers down. Because if any of those items are ever taken, the description of that item that's stolen is helpful to the police to know about, but what's most helpful is that they have that serial number. And that serial number then goes into a database known as Leads Online. And if the item by chance ends up at a pawn shop somewhere, by law, that pawn shop owner has to enter that serial number into Leads Online. And if and when he or she does, if any red flag appears to suggest that this is a stolen item, then the pawn shop owner by law is prohibited from selling that item, and is to try to obtain as best he or she can to get the identity of the person trying to get it sold. And that's helpful to police,
yeah,
more than anything.
That kind of fits in with the idea of empowering people, right?
Right.
To kind of do things on their own.
I think we can take charge of our neighborhood, but I don't think it's fair to say that the police can do everything by themselves. Mm-hmm. I think we've got a great police chief here, and I think his care and his attention to crime is going to be a positive step in moving towards reducing crime rates for our city. But again, the police can't do everything alone. They've got to have a little bit of help from those of us that are residents, and not just in my district, but in all districts. Because again, you know, if we take measures to make our homes safer and act as a deterrent to thieves, that's going to be one step in lowering petty theft and larceny. And in some cases, I think breaking and entering is down almost 36% in Hot Springs since 19. Might be off. That number might actually be higher. So that issue isn't as pressing to us as larceny and residential burglary, petty theft. But by addressing those issues and by taking these safety measures, the residents now are doing their part and working in unison with the police. And those two parts together are a lot better than just one or the other.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I think moving forward, too, we've got to get more point of contacts. That's the big step, too. That night, we came away with 4. Okay, now that essentially amounts to around 70 homes in District 4, but that number 4 has got to continue to grow. And so I'm going to be a strong advocate in trying to recruit as many point of contacts in neighborhoods as I can. And I think within a year's time, setting a goal of 100 point of contacts is realistic and achievable. And that's what I'd like to see. By this time next year, I want to visit you and say, David, we just hit 100.
So how many homes would that be?
Well, if we do the math, you know, one point of contact, and it's different for every neighborhood. There, you know, are some neighborhoods that might only have 5 or 6 homes, others that might have 20. You know, you take my subdivision, for example, off Lakeshore Drive, you know, Jenison Square, I want to say there's around 40 homes. So that's 40, one point of contact, 40 homes. But if on average one point of contact, say, gets 10 homes, that helps us.
Yeah, that's a lot of people, isn't it?
That's a lot of homes, that's a lot of people, and that's a lot of help for the police. And that has to be effective in driving that particular crime rate down. It's probably unrealistic to say that it will get to zero. So I don't want to be too naive to share that with you, but I do think it's realistic to drop it well within 50% within a year. If we hit that 100 mark on point of contacts, I think we will see petty theft and larceny drop by at minimum 50%. And I know there's some proven data that's out on neighborhoods where Chief Chapman has already installed this curriculum throughout the city, and this includes districts even outside of District 4. And that kind of takes me to what I want to share with you now, and it's if we get a system that is effective, which I think we're well on our way to do, what good does it do the city of Hot Springs if we just stop with District 4? Then it just rolls over to another district.
Right.
So it's my intentions moving forward, too, to work with other city directors to have their districts also align with what we're doing. And let's push it all the way out of Hot Springs. Let's make the entire city safer for our families and for our property, too. Phase one is point of contacts. Phase two, that's going to be really initiating a shared stakeholder approach and involving pawn shop owners. Not I got you, but I want to work with community leaders here that are familiar with proper dialect and dialogue with using law terms, such as, you know, Ms. Lawrence, even Sheriff McCormick and Chief Chapman, to help me know what I need to say when I visit with pawn shop owners, to have those owners be on board with us, you know, and to approach those owners with a solution mindset and an open mind, but yet firm enough to instill that they are using that leads online before they plan on selling any item. Because again, if we do everything in the neighborhoods to deter crime and to enact more safety measures for our family and for our property, but thieves can still sell these items here in Hot Springs that they steal, they're going to keep trying to steal. So if we initiate that phase two and have pawn shop owners on board, now thieves not only have issues with taking the items, now they've got problems even getting any money for it.
Right. They don't have a market anymore.
They don't have a market anymore. Mm-hmm. Then they're either going to turn over a new leaf, which is what I hope they do. They think, you know what, maybe this lifestyle isn't good for me. I need to be an honest person. I need to be a positive aspect for society. I'm going to change my ways. I hope they feel that way. Or they're going to leave Hot Springs and take their crime elsewhere.
Okay, yeah, I think that's a good approach. All right. Is there anything else you want to talk about?
How are we doing on time?
Well, there's really no time limit.
Okay.
As long as you can stay or whenever you're ready to go.
We've done, let's see, STRs. We've discussed a little bit of affordable housing.
What about, this is a question that I think is important, the bonuses question.
I saw that one too.
So it's pretty common practice when the board, well, per their employment contracts of the city manager and city attorney, they have a performance review every December, and it's pretty common that the board awards them an end of the year bonus. In 2020, it was, you know, 25%, which we did a poll on that, an unscientific poll here at the newspaper, but I think it was close to 90% of the people didn't approve of that. Do you think in government that that's appropriate to award bonuses? Because, you know, the city thinks of itself, the city manager form of government thinks of itself as a business. And that's an approach business uses when they want to reward their executives. Is that an approach that you should be using the city manager form of government?
Well, I'm not so sure. Yeah, I do know what you're saying with that question. I'm not so sure the city manager is type of government is a business. And I do know you're implying the way things are now is the board feels as if it is a business. I'm not so sure it is a business. And I think The 2020 bonus was too excessive. And I'm not even sure where that number came from, the 25%. It was like it was just pulled out of midair.
Right. And the frustrating thing is that the board is awarding bonuses with public funds, but because, you know, it falls under a personnel issue, they're an executive committee, and, you know, it's really a black box to the public. We don't know what they're talking about, but they're rewarding public money, seemingly with, we don't know what the criteria is, what the standards, how they're even evaluating them. You know, maybe the mayor will give us some insight when we talk to him. He usually does, but the public doesn't know what goes on back there, which I think is problematic.
Right. I do too. I think if we do enact any bonus, it should be done for exceptional performance and not necessarily automatic.
Mm-hmm.
I think there should be evaluations that take place. Now, what those evaluations look like, what they sound like, how they should be administered, that's going to be an area I would want to work on moving forward. And you know, if we don't have any evaluation for a city attorney or a city manager currently in place, let's get one. You know, if we're going to continue with bonuses for the city manager and for the city attorney, let's have some type of rubric in play. Let's have some type of matrix in play that is unbiased, that helps us measure accountability. And I think it should be done before any type of bonus is considered. We should have that matrix established, that rubric established for job performance, and base our intentions moving forward on a bonus on those unbiased results, almost like a grading scale, mm-hmm. if you will. And all of these types of considerations should be done before the annual budget process begins too. Because I think we've got to keep in mind that if we lean to the side based on the outcomes of this matrix and this rubric to grant any type of bonus for the city attorney or city manager, is the bonus allotted money there to get? You know, if it's of any harmful impact to the taxpayer money for the city, then I don't think it's a viable option.
What about the timing of that in December? You know, that's after the election. I can think of in 2020, some of those board races were really tight. And if those huge bonuses had come out before the election, I think it may have swung the outcome in some of those races. Do you think that those evaluations, if, you know, bonuses seem to be a big part of those evaluations, do you think that those should be done before the election so there's some accountability for the directors who vote on that?
That's a good point. Yeah, I think it's worth discussing. Mm-hmm. I definitely do. Because I do think you bring up a good point. It will have an impact on a race, you know, whether good or bad.
Right.
But that, again, that's depending upon performance. If the performance is great, then everybody should know about it. But if the performance is lacking, it shouldn't be kept a secret, you know, because at the end of the day, the board of directors is what and who are responsible for the decisions that affect 35,000 people. I don't like keeping secrets, and I've got no problem moving forward when we start taking on a multitude of these issues that we've been talking about today, that there is some type of shared stakeholder approach to these issues. I like that the city has the advisory committees, so that's one way that we already have installed where community leaders or residents of different districts can serve on advisory committees to help with oversight of what's happening in particular departments. But I want to expand on that even more and not just have every decision being made behind closed doors.
Mm-hmm.
Let's put it out there. You know, essentially, I would think probably 85% or higher of the decisions that are being made account for taxpayer money. You know, these decisions are being done with tax, it's all taxpayer money, and residents, voters, taxpayers, it's their money. they need to know what we're talking about. Now, that doesn't take away from exec type discussions. Those type of discussions sometimes have to take place. But as far as what's being laid out in front of the board, we've got to do, a better job of being transparent to the public on that whole decision-making process. Even the STRs that we were talking about earlier, how do we know who the 400 are? We know what the application process looks like. We know how accessible it is for somebody to get an application to apply for a potential STR licensure. Where's the rubric or the matrix to determine who's going to get it?
Right.
How do we know who's going to get it? You know, those types of decisions are what I'm saying should have a shared stakeholder approach. There should be a multitude of different people from different backgrounds that are playing into that decision making on the pro side and the con side. And you know, we were talking about bonuses, and I've got to visit with employees too. And this I found interesting, and I do want to share with you, because I know of some employees that work for the city, you know, and the city has about 600 plus employees. And if we were to compare Hot Springs to, say, with Benton, Bryant, Conway, cities of similar size as Hot Springs, I think what we will find is we have hundreds of more employees than those cities do. Do we need that many? I don't want what I'm telling you to be taken the wrong way, but I think what we've got to do is look and see if we have the right employee makeup, if you will, because that essentially affects employee pay. If we have 600 versus, say, 450 or 500, that takes away the opportunity for a lot of those 600 to make as much money as they could if we were at 450. Does that make sense?
Right. I was really stunned to hear that the entry-level wage at the city, I think they said it was $11.83 an hour.
And that essentially is where I'm going, because it's a concern for me, because I do know of residents in four who work for the city who have put in 5 or 6 years with the city, have all types of accreditations and licensures such as CDL, you know, Class Bs, and their team leaders, if you will. So they have oversight over 5 or 6 other employees. They put in on average 50 plus hours a week. Now that does factor in with overtime, and they're full time, but they request and a lot of times get overtime. However, they're having to do that to make ends meet. If the employee didn't request and obtain overtime, they would fall short on making a mortgage or buying groceries, paying for bills, you know, at their home. And so I know of a couple that have been with the city for 5 or 6 years and have all these accreditations, are team leaders and oversee 5 or 6 other employees and do all this overtime and give to the city, haven't missed an inappropriate number of days due to sickness or whatever the case may be. They're loyal, and they're making $16.01 an hour. How do you justify that?
Yeah.
So I asked, well, how often do you have for advancement? Or, you know, how do you approach requesting a raise or a bonus? And they are given an assessment to where they can certify. Now, this is one area of the city. This doesn't speak to every department and every agency. This is one area. So they take a test. And okay, so you can take a test to get a raise? And he said, yes. And I said, well, what kind of test is this? Is this test based on your experience, or is this test based on curriculum? And he said, curriculum. And I said, okay, so by curriculum, are you saying it's like a book? You've got a book? And he said, yes, we get a book. And then we've got a little bit of training that we do, and then we take a test. And I said, how long do you have to study? He said, 3 days. And I stopped there when he told me 3 days. And I said, 3 days? I said, well, is your book small or big? And he you know, motion this with his hands to indicate that the book was of pretty good size. And I said, do you have any children? And he said, yes, I've got four. So he's got four kids. He works full time. His wife works full time. He's been with the city for 5 years. He's overseeing five or six other employees. He's got all of his certifications. He hasn't got a raise in 5 years. He's making $16.01. And the opportunity, the only opportunity he has to get a raise is by taking a test that isn't based on his experience, but based on curriculum from a book that he has 3 days to study for, where the pass rate is 12%. Now, is that fair?
That's so. It's not a very high pass rate.
It isn't a very high pass rate.
You only got 3 days to study, though. So.
And only 3 days to study. So I look at that, and I thank this gentleman for sharing, and I promise to keep him anonymous, you know, but he's one of about 15 where I've heard similar stories to that. And in this department, it's my understanding that 15 to 20 have left because of the lack of opportunities for advancement. Now, these employees are the ones who are out on the grind. I think, you know, those with managerial titles, director titles, are probably representing the high end of the salary and probably have a lot to do with why the city can safely say that city employees make on average, I think it's over $40,000 a year, is it not?
I've never seen that figure. I'd be curious to know what it is.
I want to say it's somewhere in the 40s. So close to like 40, 48, 49.
Probably. And
I might be off.
Well, you look at the police department, they're probably, you know, 1/6 mm-hmm. of the city staff. And I think their starting salary is $37,000.
Well, they're at 43.8 now. Entry level.
Oh, 43.
Yeah, the police are third in the state.
That's the sheriff's department, I think. So, yeah, I mean, their starting salaries at $40,000, so that's going to push everybody up when you consider they're like 1/6 of the entire workforce.
Right. So
but then you got that guy down there making $11.83, that guy or gal down there. So, yeah.
And you then the guy who's been with the city for 5 years that's making $16.01 and has 3 days to study for a test.
Right.
So I look at this story and I think, how do we make it better for those employees? And I think what we've got to do is essentially scrap and revise the whole advancement system in Hot Springs. I really do, because that's not fair to the employee. I think there needs to be merit pay, quite frankly. I think we should look at merit pay again. It was once here. You have to excuse me, I got congestion. I think it was once here, maybe 15, 20 years ago. But I think we ought to look at a pay system that aligns itself a lot with merit. You know, if we have somebody who's been a loyal employee, hasn't missed days of work, is there on time, does everything that's asked, and I want to make sure I'm saying he or she.
Right.
And they've put in 2 years, there ought to be some automatic incentives for doing so, quite frankly. I think if you put two good, solid years, full-time employee status with the city, there ought to be automatic incentives for it. Now, what that looks like, how it transcends on a fiscal scale, I got to put pencil to paper to make that happen. But that's something that I will work on.
Yeah, that's a big issue that the board says is, or the city says is employee retention. I know they have a big problem with that.
Well, yeah, the turnover rate's too high, but that speaks to it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if I got 5 years in with the company and I'm loyal and I'm actually the one who's raising my hand to get overtime any chance I could, the least the city could do for me is give me a better opportunity for a raise. 3 days to study. I'm okay with us having an advancement opportunity using curriculum, but 3 days is not enough. I say give it to the employee the first of the month and say, hey, between now and the 31st, you get with me and tell me the day that you'd like to be tested on. Because you got to be realistic. You got to think, this is a man that has four kids, works 50-plus hours a week, trying to get overtime to provide for his family. When does he have time to study? So we got him, you know, on a realistic day, he might get 20 to 30 minutes. And I'm talking of cognitive time. There's more than 20 or 30 minutes, but time where he can sit down, focus on what he's studying, and process it, you know. you're looking at maybe 20 or 30 minutes a day, you know, to get adequate sleep. He could pull all-nighters and stuff, but how does that support his functioning at his job?
Right, yeah.
And him providing for his family. So you're looking on average, 100 to 40 minutes a week of study time. I think if we revise that type of advancement opportunity just in that area, we would do a huge service to employees. And I do think as we're revising what that type of advancement looks like, we also should be looking at, should we start with merit pay?
Right, because the city, their longevity pay system was so antiquated, I don't think it had been changed since the 70s, and they finally did change that at the end of last year. Even somebody, the city manager, who has a pretty nice salary, he was saying under that old system, he said it gave me like 10 or 12 extra dollars a paycheck. So now they do have a much better longevity system in place where, you know, if you've been there 5 or 10 years, you'll get a nice chunk of money at the end of the year.
Right. That's true. But that's definitely an area I want the city, and I will push for us to spend more time on, is in city employees. What does that pay scale look like across the board? Should we, you know, be thinking of making some changes there? How do we better the enhancement opportunities for employees? And then how do we enhance the merit system if we choose to move in that direction as well? I want to bring this up, and I'm at the start of actually putting a plan together to address this, but I do know it saddens me to say that in Hot Springs, where we have 30-plus population, and if we run the numbers on active voters and taxpayers for our city, we will find that over 65% of those are 55 and older. Now, that's a great thing. What have we given back to those residents and those taxpayers that are 55 and over? Have we given that age group a senior citizen facility? Do we have one of those in Hot Springs? And the answer is no, we don't. And I'm of the opinion we should. And I want to work. That is one of my projects to accomplish within the next 2 to 4 years, is to get Hot Springs a full-functioning senior citizen facility, somewhere where senior citizens can go to get a cooked meal, sit down and play bingo with their friends, to celebrate an occasion that's happening, birthdays, events, just general fellowship, reading time, playing different types of games together, anything to improve their quality of life. I'm of the opinion those in that bracket deserve it. They've put their time in working, whether it be with a career or a job or military or, you know, being a full-time parent. They've put their time in, and they vote. The voting numbers are pretty high for that age bracket, too. Those that are 55 and older, they get to the polls and they vote.
Yeah,
and not only do they do that, but yes, they put their time in working and being a functioning part of our society, and now is their opportunity to relax, and they need somewhere here in Hot Springs to relax. They do.
Well, I think the county and the city are working on a plan to use their ARPA money to buy a facility like that.
That I heard too. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I think they may even have an offer in on.
So I want to see that we get fruition with that, and as soon as we can. And I want to thank you, David, for having me.
Oh, yeah, thanks for coming
today.
By.
And I've got a lot more to talk about. It's a lot more issues. There are even some that we couldn't get to today. I do want to end by just sharing with those who might be listening to us today that the next District 4 Quarter Safety meeting is December 8th. That's a Thursday at 5:30 p.m. at First Lutheran Church here in Hot Springs at 105 Village Road.
Okay.
And We will have an agenda for that meeting. Number one on that agenda will be for us to reflect back over what we discussed in August and any new business that might have come out of Safe Neighborhoods in District 4. And then as we get closer to December 8th, I will revise that agenda to have new business items on it as well. But I would love to have as many residents, not just of District 4, but any district, is any resident taxpayer in Hot Springs is given an open opportunity to attend that meeting. And I would like us to pack the house. We've got food, we've got drinks, and you'll get full when you eat there.
Okay.
But I want this opportunity to help our communities be safer, to protect our families and our property. And I also want this to be an opportunity for residents to, for lack of better words, have a gripe session. And that'll be what we do at the tail end of the meeting. It can be on topic, off topic, any issue or concern that any resident has. I want to hear it because that gives me something to work on. And that essentially is why I'm taking this position. I'm here to serve everybody, not just in District 4. I want to focus most of my efforts on 4, but I'm here to serve everybody in Hot Springs. And so I'm taking this position under the pretext that there will be issues and concerns that need my help, and I want to give that help to everybody that needs it.
Yeah, sounds good.
Thank you, David.
All right, thank you, Dudley. Thanks for joining us on Garland County Vote 2022. Early voting starts October 24th and runs through November 7th. Election Day is Tuesday, November 8th.